This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Support comes from Wise, the smart way to manage the currencies you need around the world. Your life is global. Your money should be too. Some providers promise no fees on overseas transfers. Don't be fooled. Extra costs often hide in bloated exchange rates. Choose Wise. You can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies. Count on the exchange rate that you'd usually see on Google. That's how millions save billions on hidden fees. Be smart. Get Wise. Visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Turkey. Istanbul takes food seriously. Very seriously. And Meyhane restaurants are where it all comes to life. These traditional establishments are all about community, shared plates, loud conversations, and ruckus served as part of the ritual. But take a small detour and the food starts doing something different. As innovators in the kitchen, like Chef Deniz, continue to rewrite the menu.
In Istanbul, new young chefs like me develop the Turkish cuisine, but we don't replace tradition. We give it new life.
Because in Istanbul, food never stands still.
Old flavors, new ideas.
It evolves. Slowly, confidently, one plate at a time. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Something is going on in the Southern Caribbean. The world's largest aircraft carrier, American of course, is on its way to the region. Small boats said to belong to Venezuelan drug smugglers are being blown to kingdom come by the US military. Old US bases are being demothballed. And there's media talk of a Trump-induced regime change in Caracas, with Venezuela's authoritarian leftist president, Nicolas Maduro, in the crosshairs. So what does all this clatter of sabres amount to? And what does it mean for the region? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, a bit of US-Venezuela background. I'm joined by Will Grant, the BBC's Mexico, Central America and Cuba correspondent, down the line from Mexico City. Will Grant, when did this US military build-up in the Caribbean begin?
In August of this year, we started to see the US sending a lot of military hardware and troops to the Caribbean. The number of troops in the Southern Caribbean and Puerto Rico has expanded to 10,000. We've seen everything from F-35 fighter jets through to refueling tankers. We've seen the US Iwo Jima, one of the warships that's been sent to the region. It all adds up to sort of a growing sense of the clouds of war beginning to gather in the Caribbean.
What's been going on with these boats that are being blown up?
In early September, there was the first US airstrike on one of these speedboats that make their way through the Caribbean, allegedly from Venezuelan waters out through international waters, potentially to Trinidad and Tobago, but essentially heading out. Now, the argument from the US is that they were carrying drugs, bales of cocaine. We have been shown no evidence of that. All we've seen is the boats speeding through the water, suddenly in flames. Now, the first one of those took place in September, very early September. The next day, Secretary of State Marco Rubio was in Mexico City meeting the president here, Claudia Sheinbaum. And when pushed on that during a news conference afterwards, he said, look, it simply doesn't work to interdict these folks at sea because the cartels have that built into their business model. They're prepared to lose a certain amount of drugs every year, that they expect to have seizures, they expect to lose men to arrests and so on. The only thing that works and that we're going to do and that President Trump intends to do is to kill them, is to blow them out of the water, literally, blow them to smithereens. And that is a very significant and serious development in the war on drugs in the Americas. It essentially says that by placing the groups that they say are doing this drug running, calling them foreign terrorist organizations, the Trump administration believes that it has the legal basis by which it can simply carry out airstrikes on those boats. There is a lot of legal question marks over that, with people saying that there is no basis in international law for that kind of action. But the Trump administration is not just doubling down on that, it's tripling down. And of course, relating it to the president of Venezuela, saying that he is directly involved.
What happened next?
Well, it continues to be the approach of the Trump administration. The Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, just recently confirmed another one in the Eastern Pacific. He said intelligence confirmed that the vessel was involved in illicit narcotics smuggling, transiting along a known narco-trafficking route and carrying narcotics, saying two male narco-terrorists aboard the vessel were killed and that no US personnel was. Now, that takes us to more than 50 people have been killed in these strikes under the idea that they are narco-terrorists. That's the term they use. It's a very open-ended definition, but ultimately it marries two things. It marries the war on drugs with the war on terror.
President Maduro was there during Donald Trump's first term, so perhaps you can remind us what happened then between Trump and Maduro.
In Donald Trump's first term, he was very much persuaded about the validity of an opposition figure called Juan Guaido, who was then considered really the main opposition leader in Venezuela. He was the head of the National Assembly. He sort of arbitrarily declared himself president after elections that were considered neither free nor fair. And Mr. Trump backed him. I think he thought by backing him that he would see a change in power in Venezuela very, very quickly after that. Of course, it didn't happen. Nicolas Maduro is very well protected in terms of military support, in terms of ideological support with those who are around him. And he has not been as easy as Donald Trump certainly thought, I think, that he would be to remove from power in his first term. But the things that have happened involve Nicolas Maduro being indicted on charges and therefore assets being frozen and restrictions on travel and all that sort of stuff. And the accusation from the Trump administration that he is somehow the head of a cartel.
Now, what's been the public response from Nicolas Maduro since the beginning of this militarization?
Well, it's twofold, really. The first is simply to deny in any involvement in the drugs trade and paint the entire thing as a pretext by Washington to remove him from power, as you'd expect him to say. He simply says that it is a complete invention to suggest that he or his inner circle are involved in moving drugs out of Venezuela and into the world. The other thing he has said in response to everything that's happening, not just the accusations or the, by the way, $50 million bounty on his head, double the price that was asked for Bin Laden, information leading to his arrest or detention. The other thing that he has said is simply to appeal, sometimes in English during live broadcasts, for calm, for peace, that Venezuela doesn't want conflict with Washington and that calmer heads should prevail. I think he has no other choice. If he were to saber rattle in the other direction, we know that that's a calculation he's going to lose.
Is there any evidence that he has prepared the Venezuelan military to counter whatever the Americans might do, or is that just not an option?
It's a limited option, put it that way. But what we have seen, it's prepare civilian militias. That we've seen these images of these left-wing militias picking up arms, doing target practice, pensioners basically coming out and practicing with guns, things like that. The idea that Venezuela is somehow preparing itself to be on a war footing.
Will Grant, as we've heard, President Trump says it's all about the war on drugs and talks about narco-terrorism. What is narco-terrorism and how is the war on drugs going? I'm joined by Jeremy McDermott, who's co-founder and co-director of Insight Crime, a Colombia-based think tank that studies organised crime in the Americas. Jeremy, I'm not familiar with the use of this word, so perhaps you can explain it to me. Narco-terrorism. What is it?
In Colombia, we've had narco-terrorist groups for a long time, going back a couple of decades. But when President Trump took office this time, one of the first things he did was he put a series of purely criminal groups on the terrorist list, particularly the Mexicans. There were six Mexican groups, but also one and now two from Venezuela. So this has been very much embraced under this current Trump administration.
So essentially, it's been a reclassification, has it, of people who've just been previously gangs as terrorists and as narco-terrorists?
Under previous understandings, narco-terrorist groups were groups that had a political agenda but used the drug trade to fund their course. President Trump has put a series of purely criminal groups with no political pretensions in most cases on this list. Now, of course, any group that has in the US a terrorist designation allows the state to open a whole new toolbox of measures that can be employed. And that, from our perspective, who look at organized crime in the region, may be one of the principal motivators for this new series of designations.
Now, you mentioned that the narco-terrorism had its origins, a lot of it in Colombia, and spread to Mexico. What seems to be new about what's going on at the moment is the involvement of Venezuela. Can you talk to me a bit, explain to me a bit about the role that Venezuela is currently playing in the international drugs trade?
Venezuela is obviously one of Colombia's neighbours. And like all of Colombia's neighbours, and Colombia is the principal producer of cocaine in the world by far, it has been a transit nation. This is the same of Panama, Ecuador, Brazil, all Colombia's neighbours. But what's different in Venezuela is that, unlike the other countries I've just mentioned, the state has not adopted an adversarial role with the drug trade. On the contrary, the Maduro regime has begun to regulate the drug trade. And there's a particular reason for this. Maduro, after 2015, economic collapse in Venezuela, hyperinflation, increasing international isolation, and then sanctions. Teetering on the brink of bankruptcy, Maduro needed a way to maintain the loyalty, particularly of his generals, and the senior politicians of the Chavista regime, the regime set up by Hugo Chavez, from whom he took over the presidency. Now, he couldn't pay them through central coffers because he didn't have any money. So he developed a system that we call hybrid criminal governance, where he turned around to a senior military officer and he goes, okay, I know you only get paid about $30 a month, which is your salary in worthless bolivares. What I'm going to do is I'm going to send you to a place where you and I both know you're going to make a lot of money on the side. It may be on the frontier with Colombia, where there's drugs trafficking and smuggling, maybe along the Caribbean coast, where there's much of the same. It may be next to a gold mine. And this has increasingly become the way he has maintained himself in power, kept the loyalty of the military by giving them access to criminal rents.
How does this effective nationalization, if you like, almost, of an illegal drugs trade, how does it fit into the pattern of the Venezuelan gangs, which we've heard so much about having entered into the United States?
It doesn't. We're talking about two separate phenomena. Unlike Mexico, where migration and the drug trade are interwoven, in Venezuela, they're not. The particular gang that is causing or is become a part of President Trump's rhetoric is called the Tren de Aragua. It was a prison-based gang here in Venezuela, and it went transnational, not off the drug trade, but off the migrants, the Venezuelan migrants. It followed them every step of the way on their journey, exploiting them, and then continued exploiting them when they had settled. And there's more than 2 million in Colombia. There's many more in Peru and in Chile. And wherever the Venezuelans settled, Tren de Aragua and these Venezuelan gangs settled with them and got involved in the sex trade, extortion, etc. During the presidential campaign in the United States, President Trump singled out Venezuelan gangs, saying they were staging an invasion of the United States. This we found no evidence of, and we've been following the Tren de Aragua ever since it was formed. And nor have we found any cases of big cocaine shipments crossing borders linked to Tren de Aragua. Their business is not the drug trade. It's human smuggling and human trafficking principally.
In that case, what is it that Donald Trump is so incensed with President Maduro about? You said that he has enriched his generals with the drugs trade, but it's not immediately clear that that has an immediate knock-on to the United States.
No, most of the drugs that pass through Venezuela are not actually headed for the United States. If you were going to pick a principal foe in the cocaine trade, Venezuela wouldn't be the one you'd start with. Now, I wouldn't dare to know what President Trump is thinking, but here are several things that we know that the United States has problems with Venezuela over. One, the Maduro regime is a socialist regime. Secondly, its most intimate ally is Cuba, long been a foe of the United States since the days of Fidel Castro. Its closest allies on the international stage are Russia, Iran, and China. None of those on President Trump's list of favorite nations. So geopolitically, one can see how Venezuela is a target of President Trump's ire. And criminally, as we've seen, this Maduro regime is a criminal regime and it is involved in the drug trade, albeit not a major supplier to the United States.
Let's just talk about these boats now. Do we actually know or have strong suspicion about what these boats are, who's in them?
No, David, we don't. Apart from the first boat, which was struck just off Venezuela's Caribbean coast, and it was on its way to Trinidad and Tobago, which is just 15 kilometers off the coast of Venezuela. This is the boat that we were actually able to speak to some relatives of those who were killed on the boat. And it's the only really, the only details that the US have actually given out. Every boat strike since then has had less and less details. What I can tell you about that particular boat was it was not headed for the United States. I do not know if it was carrying drugs. The family member said that their loved ones were involved in smuggling. Could there have been drugs on board? Quite possibly. None of the relatives that we spoke to, of course, confirmed that. It certainly wasn't going to the United States. If there were drugs on board, maybe it was going to be maybe they were going to be unloaded somewhere else and continue their journey northwards.
Jeremy McDermott. And before we move on, I plug for the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can access the entire back catalogue, such as the one which asks why we have 25 public inquiries going on in the UK at the moment, and the one which asks how prepared we are for the next pandemic.
Support comes from Wise, the smart way to manage the currencies you need around the world. Your life is global. Your money should be too. Some providers promise no fees on overseas transfers. Don't be fooled. Extra costs often hide in bloated exchange rates. Choose Wise. You can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies. Count on the exchange rate that you'd usually see on Google. That's how millions save billions on hidden fees. Be smart. Get Wise. Visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Now back to what's happening in or close to Venezuela. I'm joined by Dr. Christopher Sabatini, Senior Fellow for Latin America at Chatham House, and Dr. Annette Edler, Associate Professor in Global Security at the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. Christopher Sabatini, in historic terms, how big is this military buildup in the Caribbean?
This is significant. There hasn't been a buildup of this size since the 1989 invasion or seizure, if you will, of Noriega, then president of Panama. You know, since then, basically, it had been primarily a Democratic hemisphere. The U.S. had not engaged in the sort of gunboat diplomacy that we're seeing right now. So this is significant. And even in absolute terms, it's significant. Right now, there's about 10 to 14% of U.S. naval assets, basically either parked off the coast of Venezuela or in Puerto Rico, presumably poised to do something. We don't know.
And I mentioned in the introduction that there's a really big aircraft carrier on its way.
That's correct. The USS Gerald Ford is steaming its way from basically off the coast of Croatia, the Adriatic Sea, towards Venezuela. It should arrive this week, but it brings with it even more firepower. This is a real large asset to be dedicated just off the coast of Venezuela.
And with the USS Gerald Ford, are we to assume that Iran's loss is Venezuela's gain?
That's exactly right. And this is what's curious, is that with an aircraft carrier of that size, the U.S. can really only afford to deploy it, not in monetary terms, but in strategic terms, for about a month. And then it will have to go back, presumably, off the coast of Yemen or other places. They're strategic hotspots.
Which raises the question, Christopher, what you think the aim of this buildup is?
I think fundamentally this is an attempt to achieve regime change on the cheap. It's been cloaked as being an issue of narcotics trafficking and take out so-called narcotics terrorists, narco-terrorists. But the truth is what President Trump is trying to do is something that he tried to do in 2019 when he created a fictional shadow interim government under then president of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, and try to convince the military to switch allegiance. It failed. Now Trump is trying to do it without explicitly calling for regime change, but he has said that Maduro is quite likely to leave or his days are numbered, was exactly what he said a few days ago. But now he's trying to do it with the threat of force and trying to scare the military into defecting and turning against Maduro and opening up for some form of regime transition.
Annette Idler, is that the way you see it as well, that the main purpose here is to provoke a regime change?
Well, I would say there are several plausible overlapping motifs, right? And one of them, yes, one of them is regime change. And this show of force clearly signals that. And it's a way to satisfy long-standing hardliners like Senator Rubio. And of course, it also sends a warning to neighboring countries such as Colombia about the limits of alignment with left-leaning governments. And we also know that there is this idea to kind of influence or incentivize even splits within Maduro's inner circle, rather than just relying solely on open invasion. So it's also about what's happening internally. But then I would also say that there's other motifs that are possible. And one really, really strongly here is the domestic signaling in the US. So what's happening with this military buildup and the bombing of the drug vessels, for example, it kind of revives this war on drug narrative, which plays very well politically in the US. Trump wants to be seen as tough on crime, right? And then finally, I would also still mention oil, right? Oil is a quieter, but still a crucial factor. We should not forget that Venezuela holds the world's largest proven reserves. And yeah, the US has just quietly tightened sanctions and tariffs to block Venezuelan crude from reaching allies like Cuba, especially, right? In that case, they cut off an estimated 50,000 barrels per day that previously sustained Havana's energy sector. So in that sense, some actually even argue that this is as much about weakening the Cuban regime as it is about Maduro himself.
I want to dig in a little more into some of those themes in a moment, Annette. But how likely actually is an invasion by American forces?
I would say that a full-scale invasion seems unlikely. What we see here is really largely performative. It's a show of power rather than really preparing for occupation. And that's important to highlight because a land operation would risk triggering perhaps even a civil conflict because we need to consider the high number of armed militias and also the fragmented opposition that exists inside Venezuela. It actually might even draw armed groups from neighboring Colombia into the mix. Also, many previous coup attempts have failed, and regime change won't be stable without really having this internal buy-in. So I guess some targeted strikes, yes, they are plausible, but using this performance for internal pressure might be another reason. And I do think a full-scale invasion is rather unlikely.
Christopher, can we evaluate this question of encouraging the coup from within? Who would be being encouraged to launch a coup? What kind of forces? And can we look at their strength?
That's exactly the problem. For a long time, the opposition in Venezuela has claimed that there's dissent within the military, there are fractions within the military, and at any moment they could defect and open the doors for regime change. That hasn't proven true in almost, well, over a decade, what they've been arguing that. And that's certainly less likely now, because one thing the Trump administration has gotten correct about Venezuela is it is indeed a regime that's deeply embedded into illicit commerce. It comprises a number of criminal networks, some of them run by generals, others run by local governors. And so where this would sort of provoke some sort of change that would be clean and produce democracy is unclear, because the truth is even if you go several layers down within this regime, there's no one that's clean. And so it's unclear, you know, why these generals or even civilian officials engaged in the government would want to defect when they would lose quite likely their livelihoods and may also lose their immunity and themselves end up being indicted for criminal activities. Right now, you do have for the first time a unified opposition, an opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who recently won the Nobel Peace Prize. The problem is that even if a so-called internal palace coup were to happen, it's unlikely a lot of the people around Maduro who had staged that coup would invite Maria Corina Machado into the presidential palace.
Annette, there are plenty of regimes around the world who President Trump may or may not approve of, Iran, North Korea, and so on. What's so particular about the Venezuelan regime that has created this kind of threat?
It is still in what unfortunately many see as the US's backyard, right? It's in the Western Hemisphere. That is quite different from regimes elsewhere in the world. And yes, Maduro leads an authoritarian regime, one that Washington and much of the international community, including the UK, the European Union, they don't recognize it as legitimate since the 2018 elections, which were widely seen as fraudulent. And then again, in 2024, we had the same issue with elections in that year. And in addition to that, yes, he has also been indicted on drug trafficking charges in the United States. I would then also add the regional dimension, right? I mean, his government has been accused of harboring criminal and insurgent groups along the Colombian border. So we're not just talking about Venezuela itself. And then finally, he did lead the country basically into a spiral of a socioeconomic crisis.
There's also a large Cuban-American constituency in U.S. politics and South Florida in particular. Secretary of State, former Florida Senator Marco Rubio, comes from the state that represents a large contingent of those Cuban Americans. And for them, they see Latin America and U.S. politics towards Latin America as being driven by a very sharp anti-communist attitude. They see Cuba surviving only because of Venezuela.
So are you saying that you could hope to get to Cuba via Venezuela?
That's exactly right. Many people believe that Venezuela, when Hugo Chavez, the Nicolas Maduro's predecessor, was first elected in 1998, sworn in 1999, that the Castro regime was on its last legs. And the oil lifeline that Hugo Chavez threw to the sinking Cuban government at the time was 100,000 barrels of oil a day. Many people thought that's what saved what was an inevitable collapse of the Castro regime. And so for them now, Venezuela is the prime target. And if you can force a regime change in Venezuela, you'll eventually bring the end of the Castro regime, and then perhaps even the end of the Daniel Ortega government in Nicaragua, sort of a reverse domino theory, if you would like. Someone close to the Trump government told me, a world power cannot be a world power if it doesn't control its own neighborhood.
Annette, can we look at what happens if there is no coup from inside Venezuela, and whether or not that will happen seems very much for the birds, really. How might this situation de-escalate? I mean, will the US forces just go away?
We know that Trump often uses military or foreign policy, really, the crisis, as a form of political distraction, right? So if a coup does not materialize, of course, he may still claim victory. And he might do that by pointing to the destruction of these so-called narco-terrorist boats, which he kind of has already done, right? But of course, if US forces withdraw without political change, the Venezuelan opposition could end up even weaker, while the regime presents itself as having resisted yet another US intervention. So it will have clear repercussions kind of inside Venezuela. And then of course, we also have seen how quickly Trump jumps just from one potential or actual war theater to the next one, from Ukraine to Gaza, back to Ukraine, to Venezuela. But overall, what the region really needs is sustained and internally supported engagement, one that goes beyond these quick headlines, but really addresses the root causes of both the organized crime related crisis and, of course, also what's happening in terms of democracy.
Christopher.
What will happen, say, within a month or two? I think Donald Trump has been very careful about not describing this as regime change. He talks about how Maduro's days are numbered. But Marco Rubio and Peter Hezegath, the Secretary of War Defense, they've talked more openly about regime change. Donald Trump is not. And there will come a possibility that he decides it's too risky, either he's to launch an invasion, which I think is very unlikely, or even to launch a few missiles, which is likely, and then just declare victory and say, well, we won the war against narco-terrorism. We blew up those boats. We took out a few landing strips in Venezuela. Time to go home. So he has an escape hatch if he wants it, because I simply don't think he has the stomach to actually address and become responsible for the likely chaos that could be generated should he invade or should he promote a really dramatic upheaval within Venezuela.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Christopher Sabatini, Annette Edler, Jeremy McDermott and Will Grant. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirsty Knight and Cordelia Hemming. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli, the sound engineer was Gareth Jones, and the editor was Richard Barden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again very, very soon.
Hi, I'm Phil Wang, and this is a podcast-to-podcast trailer for a different podcast than this podcast that you've listened to or are going to listen to. But nonetheless, I'm talking about another podcast that you should also definitely listen to. The podcast I'm talking about is Comedy of the Week, which takes choice episodes from BBC sitcoms, sketch shows, podcasts, and panel shows, including my own show, Unspeakable, and puts them all into one podcast. Maybe I'll trail this podcast on that podcast. Who's to say? I'll do what I like. Listen to Comedy of the Week now on BBC Sounds. Podcast.
Support comes from Wise, the smart way to manage the currencies you need around the world. Your life is global. Your money should be too. Some providers promise no fees on overseas transfers. Don't be fooled. Extra costs often hide in bloated exchange rates. Choose Wise. You can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies. Count on the exchange rate that you'd usually see on Google. That's how millions save billions on hidden fees. Be smart. Get Wise. Visit Wise.com. T's and C's apply.